Heyo! Welcome back to the Rotobomb Podcast. It's been a while. My apologies on that front, but I've been having fun. I've been taking a little bit of a break, recharging my batteries, working on rankings every day for an hour or so, putting a lot of time in on my dynasty teams, and definitely just sort of recharging the batteries. And this is a big podcast because I actually was looking to record this really tomorrow or the next day, but I finally came to sort of a meeting of the minds with my web developer and the rather ambitious podcasting setup that we had considered getting into, which I'd sort of been holding off my process on. Once I got down to brass tacks with him, it's not something I can afford to do at this point. It's just, quite frankly, too much money. So, there's going to be a little bit of a disjointed process for me in terms of how I post podcasts. But I think for you all, the listening audience, I think it's going to be a lot better. The way I'm going to do it now, I'm going to basically use Podbean to post most of my official podcasts. There will be some smaller, shorter ones on Rotobomb that won't be on the main feed. And those will generally be small audio clips that aren't really podcasts. I may want to do a 10-minute mini podcast that goes with an article, that kind of thing. You may see some of that stuff only on the Rotobomb website, but proper podcasts, you know, the ones that go on for, you know, more than a half hour are always going to be on the main feed. And I'm going to get really as many of the outlets hooked up as possible. It's going to be on iTunes. It's going to be on Stitcher. Whatever other platforms you guys really want, please communicate it with me. I'll do my very best to get them up on as many as I can, as long as it doesn't break my pocketbook. After the long windup, the windup's over. We're going to get into some cool topics today. I've been active on Twitter the last week or so, had some pretty hot conversations. And as usual, you get to a point on Twitter where it's just sort of pointless. You know, it's like, well, I guess I could take a thousand words and break them down into a bunch of tweets and try to actually say what I really think on this topic. But I know I'm going to get interrupted a million times. It's going to go in nine different angles and tangents and so forth. And the point gets lost. So I'm going to wrap up some of these ideas in today's pod. And I want to thank all the people who took part in these conversations on Twitter for their takes, for their angles, and for not calling me any bad names or anything like that. At least I don't think anybody did. I might have missed it. But anyway, the one we're gonna start with, and if you are listening to this on Rotobomb, it's probably worth mentioning, it's still really the best place to listen to these podcasts because on Rotobomb, I can build some article stuff underneath it. Just so you know, if you're on your computer right now, your PC, switch over and listen on Rotobomb just because you can actually look at the tweets I'm talking about. I embedded them underneath the podcast. So check those out if you want to. Let's move on to our first topic. I sent out a tweet yesterday about Dante Pettis and Deebo Samuel. I'll just read the thing for those of you who can't see it. One of Dante Pettis or Deebo Samuel almost has to be legit valuable for fantasy football this year. Both maybe, but one almost assuredly. Here's the thing. If you draft Pettis, you'll usually have a few shots at Deebo late in the draft. Nabbing both makes loads of sense in deep PPR formats. Okay, so I thought that was pretty obvious, but, people like to go on tangents on Twitter, and, hey, I definitely do it myself, so I'm not throwing blame or anything like that or shade. But the point of this tweet, it's obviously a fantasy football strategy thing within the draft. I love Pettis. I'm big on Pettis. Anybody who read my rookie reports last year, I was really high on Dante Pettis. I sort of fell for him when I was doing my work on John Ross back in like 2017. He's just a player who's always around the play. He's got a real feel for the sport, good at the game. He is obviously got a lot of natural athleticism passed down from his father who played pro baseball. And he's just a well-schooled player. You watch Dante Pettis play, and not only can you tell that this is a player who's had some good coaching, he definitely has had that. He's also a player you can tell accepts good coaching. And that's big, man. And it's especially big early on in your career. Then he goes to a guy like Shanahan, who's a teacher, and I just think this marriage is going to work. The only thing to me that's going to hurt Dante Pettis is injury, and he's going to be susceptible to it in this scheme where they're setting him up for yards after the catch, in my opinion. He's going to be vulnerable to getting banged up. He's a guy who's not quite 190 pounds. Maybe he's over that now, but he's not a big receiver. He's not necessarily built for a lot of contact. So I'm high on the player. I think he's going to have an outstanding career if he stays healthy. But my concern is injury. So it makes sense, for if you have my point of view, if you hold my point of view, that if you can get a guy like Deebo Samuel, who is, really quite the handful out of the slot, if something were to happen to Pettis, it is almost impossible for me to envision a scenario where Samuel doesn't become a huge part of that offense. Now, a couple people mentioned Marquise Goodwin's name. And, look, there'll be some correlation there, too. Obviously, if a major player leaves the rotation, there's going to be more for the other people left. So, if Goodwin is getting X number of snaps when Pettis is healthy and Pettis goes down, it'll be X plus. There's no doubt about that. At least, I don't think so, unless something happens to Goodwin or unless he plays himself out of the rotation and those new touches go to someone else. Which brings me to another point, that this is a deep depth chart, and they like guys who can move around and play different places. Trent Taylor is clearly a slot, but he could play outside. He can do it. Deebo and Pettis, these guys can play anywhere. Marquise Goodwin, you want him to play slot, he can do it. This team has got a lot of versatility. Jordan Matthews is another guy with versatility. Jalen Hurd's a guy who's probably going to have route versatility, formational versatility. Richie James and Trent Taylor, probably the two guys who are mostly slots, but again, very good football players who can do other things. So that seems to be a theme, a trend. It's not accidental that the 49ers have these types of players who are smart, who work hard, who are good fundamentally. My whole thing is I see Pettis and Deebo as being at the center of this offense, and I think they are guys they really want to use a lot. And if something happens to Pettis, I think Samuel, I would be really surprised if he did not step into a high-volume role. It would surprise me. And that's the point of the whole thing. Nothing against any of these other fine players. And Goodwin certainly is one. Sigmund Bloom brought Goodwin's name up. And I think it was Sig, and I think some other people pointed this out as well, that, regardless of what you think of Goodwin in terms of maybe being injury prone over his career and what's happened in recent years in terms of them adding other talent, we can still look back and look at Goodwin on the field with Jimmy Garoppolo, and I think it's pretty clear that there was a connection there. They were comfortable with each other. So I think writing off Goodwin at this stage, I don't think that's the way to go. I think Goodwin, quite frankly, I like him a lot in best ball from a makeup perspective. The reason I'm probably not as high as him on him, excuse me, as some, is just, he's just been a little brittle. And when it comes to best ball, I really err on the side of guys who are healthy and who tend to stay that way. It's just my thing in best ball. So 49ers receivers, that was my whole thought process behind this thing. I think Pettis is the guy to target right now, but I do think he's got some durability concerns because of his size and the style of football they want to play. And I think Samuel, who could have standalone value even if Pettis is healthy, for sure, in my opinion, but I think it's sort of a no-brainer that if Pettis is out, Samuel becomes a bit of a volume weapon, obviously, along with Kittle. Kittle's a constant in all of this stuff. Okay, let's move on. Let's move on to the next topic. Derrick Henry is a guy I've been talking about a lot last couple months. I included the video I did for Player Profiler. If you're watching this on Rotobahn, you can watch that video. I won't get into the whole thing about why I like Derrick Henry. It's pretty obvious. And the tweet you'll see, again, if you're listening to this on Rotobahn, some of you guys probably saw it. If you're Rotobahners, you probably saw it. But here's what I said. People debating Derrick Henry in a binary way. And in my humble opinion, they were missing the boat. Sure, the Titans could punk us along and do God knows what with their backfield. You just never know. The reason to draft Henry is that his upside at cost is league winning. Okay, so obviously a lot of people respond with, here's why Derrick Henry's going to be bad. Here's why you shouldn't draft Derrick Henry. Okay. That was not what the tweet was about, okay? I'm not making my argument for Derrick Henry here. I'm making the argument for why you draft him, okay? There's a difference, okay? We all can sort of find, like, hey, I think Derrick Henry's a 50-50 shot. 50% bust, 50% make it. Some might think he's a 75-25, okay? That's not really the point. What I'm trying to point out here is that if he does hit, okay, he can change the face of your team and your league. Okay, because this is a guy that, now look, I've seen him in expert drafts going early second round, but this is a guy who every draft I've been in this year, almost everyone, unless I'm the guy who takes him, I've taken him in the third round several times, but unless I take him in the third, he gets to the fourth. That's every draft I've been in this year. So I'm looking at him in that context, that he can be head mid to late third, or early to mid fourth in that area. So when you're taking Derrick Henry as your third player and you already have an elite running back and you probably already have an elite receiver and then you add Derrick Henry, that is a heck of a way to start a fantasy football team. You've got a lot of solidity, you've got upside. If Derrick Henry hits, you're a league winner, man. Maybe somebody else happens to hit on something just as good and they have a base just as good and you're one of the best teams. And, you know, I mean, it's fantasy football, man. You're never guaranteed a title, right? But he is the kind of player who is right at the core of the philosophy I've been talking about on this website, on this podcast, for the last 3 or 4 years. This has become my personal mode of operation, modus operandi, whatever you want to call it, in drafts, which is I'm always obsessed with who can demolish this draft spot. And I get to that late third round, and Derrick Henry's one of the guys. It's like, hey, this guy hits. He's going to be putting up late first round digits. Who knows? Maybe even better. That's the point, okay? You want guys who can redefine your team. And when you get a guy in the third round who has a solid shot at playing like a guy in the first round, you know what? I'll take that every time because I'm at a point in the draft where, hey, because look, Derrick Henry's floor is probably around the fifth round right now, just based on if you look at that team. I mean, they're going to use him. What else are they going to do? They're going to go to 29-year-old Deion Lewis who let them down last year? I don't think so. I think they really have, if you just look at last year and look at the way it flowed, you would be insane not to at least try Derrick Henry as your lead back. For this season. For Henry, he's in a contract year. There's all kinds of reasons to argue for him, and there's plenty of reasons to argue against him. The Titans play a tough schedule. If a lot of these games go wrong in terms of script, we don't know how they're going to handle that. There's plenty of downside to this player. I'm not denying that. What I'm trying to explain is that when you get this type of upside with your third player that you're taking in a fantasy draft, that's compelling because this is one of the ways that you win leagues. And I mean, for me, I don't care if I don't come in first. I mean, sure, if you say, hey, you're not gonna win this league, would you rather come in second or last? Yeah, sure, I'll take second. But primarily the thing I really want is A, the title, the hardware, the trophy, whatever you want to call it, and B, the payout. I want the money and I want the title. I mean, after that, if I can't get it, yeah, sure, I'd rather do poorly than crappy. But on a scale, I don't really care. The thing I really care about is winning leagues. So as I've talked to you guys over the last couple of years, you go into a league, you've got a 1 in 10 shot or a 1 in 12 shot or maybe a 1 in 14 shot, depending on your league size, okay? It's really important that you embrace those odds. A lot of people, just sort of to protect their own mental fragility, look at things sort of in a binary fashion. I either win the league or lose the league, and slowly you morph into this thing like it's a 50% proposition, which it's not. You're always a long shot when you walk into a league, at least from a statistical point of view. You're one team of probably 12, all chasing the same thing. So I'm much more focused on finding a path to the top versus worrying about what might sidetrack me or submarine my season, because the reality is 11 of us are going to get submarined, and one of us is going to hold the title. So I'm much more concerned in terms of finding a path to the summit than worrying about ways that I might fail, because failure is expected, statistically speaking. I mean, I think when you get yourself into that mindset, some people might think, well, that's a loser's mentality. It's only a loser's mentality if you approach it that you're actually going to lose. It's not a loser's mentality because it's actually forcing you to focus on the things that will make you win. And to me, it's just a better mindset. And that's how I do it. It's not that I play with a lack of confidence. It's that I'm open-minded to the reality of the situation. Okay. Anyway, rant over. But that's the thing with Henry, is that Henry's a player who can really put you in a position to win titles. Now we can get into another debate about what do you think his percentage chance of actually hitting that upside is. And that's a good discussion. But the point of my tweet here is, why are we drafting Derrick Henry? The reason why you draft him, and again, you can have a separate reason for not drafting him, but the reason why we draft him is because he's a guy who can help you win a league. That's why. Is there anything else we want to say about Henry here? Just trying to think. Am I missing anything? Let's kill the Henry thing, because I'm running out of time here. We could go into some stuff about, you know, that offense and how things can go wrong. There's definitely ways that the Henry pick can go wrong, but let's just stick with what I'm trying to say here, and that's it's important to understand why we do things in fantasy football. And the reason you go after Henry is because he's a potential league-winning player. Obviously, there are a lot of other ways you can go this year. Now, moving down to the next thing on the list, which is Tampa. I posted that, hey, I like Bruce Anderson and Ronald Johnson just fine. But it's sort of funny how folks are discounting Peyton Barber in the Tampa backfield. He's the most proven commodity they have. Arians gave a washed, suboptimal Mendenhall 217 carries at a 3.2 clip back in 13. You know, this is a guy who basically had his career ruined by a bad ACL outcome. Arians, just because he trusted him, I mean, he was a plotter, but Arians gave him a lot of juice that year. He basically made Mendenhall lose the job, and he did. So my point is, take Barber seriously. This is a coach who will sit there and play the back that he trusts versus going after the upside. He's shown that he will do that. So I think Barber's a guy you have to take seriously. Am I taking Peyton Barber in the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th round? No, I'm not. But what I'm saying is, right now, when I look at this backfield, I think Barber really probably has as good a chance at leading it statistically as the other two backs. And I think he should be seen as such. Now, a couple people pointed out to me that Barber's ADP is rising. I was really just doing more of the old lick your finger, stick it up in the air, see how the wind's blowing. I just don't hear anybody getting Barber's back, and I feel like somebody should, because he's a good, solid interior runner who can get it done. And if, you know, if Rojo flops again and Bruce Anderson plays like a rookie, Peyton Barber would actually end up with pretty serious upside in a Bruce Arians offense, because unlike Mendenhall, he's not washed. He can still do it. He's not great, but he's solid. That's the point. Now, let's move on to the thing that actually got sort of big yesterday. Jason Wood, a writer for Football Guys, who is, you know, not a friend of mine, not a guy that I follow. He doesn't follow me. We don't have a bad relationship. We just don't really know each other. But I saw a tweet from Jason that said, if Todd Gurley only delivers, and delivers is a big word in this discussion, by the way, because a lot of people were using the word deliver to indicate playing time. And what Jason did not say, he didn't say if Todd Gurley gets 60% of his playing time, he'd be worth X. He's saying if he gives you 60% of the production, he'd be worth X. And I think that's an important distinction to make. You know, because a lot of people were attacking him from a different angle on that, which is completely unfair. He was also attacked for saying it's shameful to suggest otherwise at the end of the tweet. I mean, sure. I think Jason walked that back himself in the thread. I mean, look, we all want to go out and throw a hot take out, and sometimes we think that just because we're not talking to a specific person, nobody will take offense to what we say. I think Jason probably had that in the back of his mind when he put this tweet out. And then when people started saying, hey, are you calling me shameful? He's like, you know, he walks it back. He wasn't trying to, I don't think, get into anybody's grill. excuse me. But from my angle, even though I don't agree with what Jason says 100%, I think, and this is the key point that I was trying to make in this whole thing, is nobody is really talking about the value of Gurley if you take him. Everybody's saying fade Gurley, fade Gurley, fade Gurley. And you know what? Maybe they're right. Excuse me. Maybe they're right. But nobody is really articulating the other side of this debate well, in my opinion. Or at least, you know, the sightings of these folks are few and far between on Twitter. And I think this is a huge topic that really should be talked all the way through. And I think when we look at Gurley, it's a really weird situation. I hate commingling these two topics, like domestic violence and football, but there's sort of a Ray Rice element to this whole thing, which is we saw Gurley struggling on the football field. We saw it with our own eyes. You can hear about something, you can theorize about something, but seeing is different. And in Gurley's case, he went out on the field and played football, and he looked terrible. And people can't get the bad stats, the bad look, the bad scenario, the bad outcome, the general badness of what happened to their fantasy football team. People have trouble clearing that out of their mind. And look, we've all been there. I'm not blaming people. But look, excuse me. It's important to look at this in context. And I actually went into a thing, and I hate talking about myself in these things, but I am a sufferer of arthritis. I'm an athlete with knee arthritis, and I've done my ACL in my left knee, my MCL in my right knee. I've had meniscus problems. I've got significant arthritis in both of my knees, and I'm still an athlete. I still play, and I go through periods where I can't play because my knee gets tweaked. It starts acting up. So, I mean, I know what it's like to have an arthritic knee. Excuse me again. I don't know what it's like to be a world-class athlete, okay? And I never will, and I was never on a course to experience that on any level. But I know from my own experience battling knee arthritis that when it's acting up, it's tough. But when things are right, in my case, I'm right as rain. I'm pretty much free and easy. So my point is that this stuff changes. There are ebbs and there are flows. And I haven't seen the medical information that tells me that Todd Gurley can't get back to free and easy at some point. For all we know, he's there now. So let's go back and look what happened. He had a knee injury, and it happened towards the end of the season. And in coming back from that knee injury, the arthritic condition in his knee became an issue. But the arthritic condition in his knee wasn't the thing that sent him into the tailspin. I think it was a factor in him getting back. Because once that joint gets all inflamed and it gets all messed up inside, and you've got an arthritic condition in there, the process gets slowed down. So I think he was slow to get back to full health. And maybe that's something we want to talk about. Hey, what we're seeing now is that if Gurley gets tweaked, it can take him a while to get back. Now, I think that's definitely a fair point. And it's certainly fair to speculate that maybe this is just going to be the way it is for the rest of his career. I'm not saying that's not possible. But I also think it's faulty to assume that that's the case. And as I said on Twitter yesterday, what we have is a condition and an injury. And at the later stages of last season, he's dealing with a condition and an injury simultaneously. What I want to know is, what is the state of the condition once the injury has been cleared? And I think we're going to find that out maybe in camp, although obviously information coming out from the team could be rosy just because they feel like telling us good things. You know, we can't trust what the coaching staff is going to say, and we may not see him in preseason. So there's a scenario here. And, you know, we can all put our own percentage on it. But there's a scenario here where Todd Gurley shows up week one. We haven't seen him all preseason. And he looks like, wait for it, Todd effing Gurley. So I can't get that really out of my mind. And I haven't decided where I'm going to be in my redraft leagues on this player yet. But that's the point. I haven't decided yet. I think it's premature to decide, and I want more information. So, you know, that's sort of where I'm at with Gurley. I thought Jason was really bringing up an important point, and I said so. As for all the other reasons and JJ's article, which I did go and read if you're going through the thread, JJ wrote a good article, but it does not really address the point that Jason made, in my opinion, and it doesn't address the point that I'm trying to make, which is that we really don't know. And a full fade could end up being really smart. And I may be a person who ends up fading Gurley myself, but I really do think we're in a place where none of us have the correct amount of information to make a fully informed decision. And it's really going to be about your risk tolerance. And that's the point that I got to. And if you read my tweet, what I said is it's not a move that's for everyone, because some people don't want to take a risk with their season. Some people, the actual 13 weeks of the regular season, being able to enjoy those 13 weeks is a big part of why they play fantasy football. And they don't want to risk taking it down early because of Gurley, okay? And that's perfectly understandable. But there are other of us who really care about winning and are interested in this not in terms of the arc of our enjoyment of the season. It's just a matter of, will this give me a better chance to win my league or a worse chance to win my league? And quite honestly, if you see, the 60% was an arbitrary number that he threw out. My thing is, I think Gurley could be 80% of what he was, maybe even more. I mean, I definitely think they're going to rest him more than they have, perhaps a lot more than they have. But if Gurley's playing well, I mean, I don't see them like turning that thing into a committee. Why would they do that? It doesn't make any sense. And if their ultimate thing is they want to get out of Gurley's contract maybe at the end of this year or next, well, there's no real reason to save the tread on his tire, is there? So there's a lot of potential scenarios here. Again, I think it's important to continue to look at this player. Giving up on him too soon, I think, is a mistake. Ultimately, you may make the same decision, but this is a player to continue to grind on, to continue to hear what's coming out of camp. And, you know, for all we know, what if Darrell Henderson has a bad preseason and Malcolm Brown isn't having a great preseason? For all we know, they could need Gurley more than we think. Probably not, but, there's a lot of things that can happen in training camp. And so to me, this is still a live situation, and I'm still very, very open-minded to taking Todd Gurley, especially if he continues to slip. You know, I mean, I've seen him late second round. I've seen folks in a situation where they can go Kamara, Gurley, Derrick Henry, or Kamara, Gurley, Diggs, or Kamara, Gurley, Kittle, or Zeke, Gurley, Kittle. I mean, these are the kind of starts. It's like, you're going to give me a chance to do that. I might have to take it, even though I know I'm risking my season. I think it's important that we continue to have these conversations. You know, ultimately, you may fade Gurley, and that's great, because you need to do what works for you. But I don't think this is one we want to put away too soon. Anyway, couple more things here. Next topic is going to be the Carolina backfield. Okay, you know, wait, one more point on Gurley. I'm sorry, before I close this down, man, you go on these long rants. Sometimes you forget what you've said and what you haven't said. But one more just quick point on Gurley, and this is actually an important one, so I want to make sure I get this in. People talk about this arthritic knee condition, and I've heard a lot of people say, hey, this goes all the way back to college. This isn't something that just popped up out of nowhere. The Rams have been worried about this for a long time. Ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. You know, it's not something that just happened to him week 14. Well, yeah, I mean, that's sort of the whole point, isn't it? Because Gurley was kicking ass for a lot of last year with this supposed condition. So I'm sort of repeating what I said earlier. We've got an injury and we've got a condition. And there was an injury which may have exacerbated the condition. So now you're dealing with a heightened condition plus an injury, or however you want to spin it. But let's not forget, the condition predated the whole thing? Well, he was kicking ass with that condition for a long time last year. So again, back to the whole original thing. If the injury is passed and we go back to the condition, if they can get the condition manageable the way it was before the injury last year, it seems possible to me that the Todd Gurley we see in September could look a whole lot like the Todd Gurley we saw last September. It seems very possible. Now, probable? I don't know. And, you know, as I already said, more susceptible to an injury, which could then have a longer than normal recovery time. Yeah, there's definitely on two or three levels, there's more risk to Gurley this year. Okay. And nobody is suggesting you go take him at the top of the draft. But I think what Jason was suggesting and what I'm suggesting here is that this is still a live thing, and that when he's slipping into the second round, you got to do your due diligence on that. You know, and you just do. So I'm going to keep talking about this. It's going to, you know, Gurley's one of those people that's going to be keeping me up nights. He's the big tamale in the draft now. Tyreek Hill is on some level settled, and this is sort of where we're at. So again, I'll wind this up one more time. Next topic is the Carolina Panthers. Now, just before I went into the studio here, parentheses, my attic, I posted a tweet, a fill-in-the-blank tweet. If Christian McCaffrey goes down, blank will get the most backfield touches in his stead. And the answers really worked well for what I want to do here, because I was getting a lot of answers of players who are not on the Panthers, which is sort of the point. It does not seem like they have a viable backup option to Christian McCaffrey. Now, maybe these folks are right. Maybe they're angling for Kareem Hunt or Jay Ajayi. Maybe they're hoping they can get their hands on Duke Johnson or somebody like that. That certainly would make a lot of sense given the current state of this backfield, right? I mean, let's take a quick look at the Carolina backfield. I mean, we're looking at guys like Cameron Artis Payne. We're looking at, you know, a rookie who ran like a 6 second 40. Although I like Elijah Holyfield, I'm poking fun, but I think he's a pretty good football player. Jordan Scarlett, who is an intriguing block of clay, but I don't see any way that guy's ready for prime time. He's nowhere near ready to replicate what Christian McCaffrey does in that offense. Back to Cameron Artis Payne for a second. I mean, you know, not a bad backup running back in the NFL, but they would have to completely change the offense if they went from McCaffrey to CAP. You know, Elijah Hood, I mean, you know, whatever. I'm not here to dog Elijah Hood, but no way is he solving their problems. If McCaffrey went down, they do not have a player behind him in that backfield that has anything remotely close to his skill set. No, I mean, not even in the same galaxy. I mean, there's nobody in the entire NFL who actually has McCaffrey's skill set. You could maybe argue Saquon Barkley, and then obviously Barkley has a whole bunch of stuff McCaffrey doesn't have. But a running back, and I've talked about this on this podcast a gazillion times, I'm not going to go down this rabbit hole, but McCaffrey is special. He does things when you break formation that few players can do. Where am I going with this? If you already read the Twitter thread, you actually knew from the start. But my opinion is that the answer to the question is on the roster. It's just not in the running back part of the depth chart. I think Curtis Samuel is the answer to the question. I think we're probably going to be staring at a Ty Montgomery scenario if something happens to Christian McCaffrey. Now, here's where I could be wrong, is if there is a roster move between now and the season. If they bring in Duke Johnson, that changes everything, okay? Because Duke Johnson is sort of McCaffrey-light, okay? That would change everything. And obviously there's a couple more players that they could bring in who are more diverse, who maybe could change the calculus of what we're talking about here. But let's not forget, the Panthers drafted Curtis Samuel right after McCaffrey. And I remember a lot of people at the time going, well, these are redundant skill sets. Why would you do this? Well, I don't know. Maybe this was part of their plan all along, that if something happened to McCaffrey, Samuel's there. And, they can turn Samuel into some type of hybrid player. I mean, there's no rule that says Samuel can't continue to do some of his wide receiver things while also putting some running back stuff on his plate. It's not like it's something Curtis Samuel's never done before. He did just that at Ohio State. So this is a player who literally is also a running back. It's not like Curtis Samuel's never played running back. He has. The bottom line is this, well, let's just go back for a second. I mean, not only has he played running back, this is a guy who carried the ball 172 times at Ohio State. It's not like every now and then they let him play a little running back. Guy had 172 carries. Now, some of them were on jet sweeps and stuff like that. Let's be fair. But this guy is a less polished, more explosive version of his more famous teammate. The Panthers' offense would scarcely change if they switched from CMC to Samuel. You'd still be presenting the same basic problems for opposing defenses. Of course, it would be, you know, a hit to the team because if Samuel's in the backfield, he's not playing outside. There's going to be a domino, ripple effect, whatever you want to call it. The equation goes like this. This offense would be better off playing their wide receiver depth at wide receiver than their RB depth at running back. You're going to lose more if you put, Cameron Artis Payne on the field than if you go to Chris Hogan at receiver or if you go to Torrey Smith, or Jarius Wright or whoever they might decide to put in there. Okay. That's sort of the point. Basically you're keeping your offensive paradigm in place, right? Now, again, Samuel isn't Christian McCaffrey. He does not have the route ability that McCaffrey has, but he's a wide receiver. He's obviously got way more route ability than a typical running back, right? So to me, this is sort of obvious. I just don't see this team saying, well, we have a guy that can replace McCaffrey, but he's a receiver, so we're just going to go in this suboptimal route, and we're going to put, one of these running backs back there who can't do, like, any of the stuff McCaffrey can do. I just don't see him doing that. So to me, this just makes a lot of sense unless they actually make some type of roster move, which is possible. So that was a lot of words. And I guess some of you are probably saying, okay, maybe you're right, Pete, but is any of this actionable? Like, what does this do for me? Well, I guess the first part would be don't try to handcuff McCaffrey with any of these running backs. I think you're wasting a roster spot. And maybe consider bumping up Samuel in your rankings because I think even if you can't use him as a handcuff to McCaffrey, which you can't unless a lot of these leagues would then switch Samuel's positional eligibility. So there's a little bit of a thing there, right? But if you're a Christian McCaffrey owner and Curtis Samuel is there, at his normal ADP, it might not be a bad idea. At least if something happens to McCaffrey, you'd probably get a bump up in Samuel's value. So there's that. The bottom line is right now Samuel's standalone value is higher than his ADP. Now it has been bumping up. I mean, I was getting Curtis Samuel in the 13th, 12th round of best balls a couple months ago. He's moving up into that 9th round range now, but I still think he's a value. And again, I think, the point here, if I'm wrong and you draft Curtis Samuel at ADP, you're not going to lose anything. You're going to get a good player at ADP. If I'm right and McCaffrey goes down, Samuel could end up being like a high-end wide receiver two or better if he's getting all Christian McCaffrey's touches. Anyway, the point here is I think something's wrong when you look at this backfield. There's a missing piece, and it's either going to be filled via the scrap heap when people start getting cut. Could be McCoy, could be a Duke Johnson trade, who knows. But if that doesn't happen, I think they're going to end up filling it in the manner in which I'm suggesting. And I think that's something that's worth knowing about. I think it makes Samuel a more valuable player, and it certainly, in my opinion, underscores the lack of value in any of these people listed behind McCaffrey on the depth chart. Okay, so we're going to hit one more topic here before we wrap this turkey up. Oh, and, just one more thing on McCaffrey, because I know you guys want to hear me babble on this another 10 seconds. But if I'm correct, I think one really important takeaway here is that they have no intention of scaling back McCaffrey. I mean, that's another positive. The fact that maybe they've got his backup as a break glass if necessary kind of option might just underscore their intent to play a whole lot of McCaffrey this year, because they don't really care about his backup unless he goes down. So it could be a telegraphing of their intent to use McCaffrey as like an every down kind of player the way they did last year. So I think that may be a takeaway from this as well. Okay, one last thing I want to talk about, and this is just to Billy B, who sent me an email. Billy, I read it. I almost want to post this email because it was like 13 roster shots inside the same email. But I went through it, man, because if you put that much effort, I feel like I had to get back to him. And here's the thing I want to bring up. And I'm not going to talk about any of the specific players. I want to sell this guy out to his league mates or anything like that. He says he found out Rotobon from a guy in his league. So he's got at least one guy in his league with eyeballs who could be on this. So I don't want to sell him out. But he's talking about basically gutting his dynasty team. He's got a lot of old guys. And he said that he basically took like everybody who's older than 27, put him on the block. He's going to move every guy on his team who could go over the hill in the next couple of years. He's dealing for future picks and blah, 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 blah. He's basically just gutting it like crazy. And I just wanted to bring out a point that I think sometimes when we're ready to flip the switch and you know what, let me just be honest about this. I do play a lot of Dynasty, and I do have, like, depending on your definition of a Dynasty league, about 7 or 8 Dynasty teams. I've only done a rebuild once, so I got to be honest about that. I did take over an orphan and had to do a rebuild because it was awful, and ironically enough, it is finally rebuilt this year, and the league just died, but that's a whole other sob story. So we'll take a quick diversion here and mention that it is always important to look at the long-term viability of an individual league that you're A, about to join, or maybe B, about to get into a long-term rebuild. That's not always the thing to do if you think the league could go down in a season. And I think I've heard a couple really smart Dynasty people mention this in the past, and I think it bears repeating that the quality of the league itself and the commissioner should have a lot to do with whether you join a league. And if you do join, it could have something to do with the strategy that you choose to imply in a league. If you don't think the league is long-term viable and you're sort of doing it just because a bunch of people are asking you to or whatever the case may be, then it might be a good time to use a short-term strategy, try to get an early title. And if the league holds together and you like it, then you can go for rebuilding when that time comes. You know, I'm a build-by-youth person by nature, but I do think it is important to look at a league you're in and to profile the league. And if you have no faith that a league's going to be around in 4 years, then doing a slow rebuild may not be a good idea. But anyway, so Billy B sent me this email, and he's obviously about to just start throwing players overboard like they're ballast, and he's in a hot air balloon. And I thought it would be a good time to just talk about, and I threw this in the email to Billy, but I'm going to say it on this podcast, that there can be a difference between dynasty austerity, which can be a positive thing if you do it correctly, and what I would call like dynasty bloodletting, which is sort of, for those who know what bloodletting is, it's like a medieval medicinal tactic that has very little medicinal value. None, I guess. So we don't want to just blindly bloodlet. We want to have an idea when it's time to rebuild. So, you know, austerity is one thing, but just going crazy and hacking everything blindly is something else. I mean, you know, this stuff never happens on a straight curve. You can still zig and zag through a rebuild. You may see a veteran that's available at a great price. So your mindset shouldn't be, no veterans. If he's at a good price and you can flip him, do some business. You know, if you think you can get a guy for a third and flip him for a second, who cares what his age is? Make the move. Do it. Because rebuilding is about creating value. So, you know, I'm all for young. I'm all for building through the draft. And I'm all for austerity when the situation merits austerity. But be careful about the bloodletting. Have an idea about what you're doing. When I did my rebuild, and you can try this exercise. I mean, some really wise veteran owners who are listening, if you have a better idea or a deeper process, by all means, you know, tweet to me, let me know. But what I did when I did my one rebuild that I've done is the first thing I did was I categorized my assets. You know, I put them into general categories like keep, sell now, sell later, sell high when high occurs, and then fragility holds. Now, you may have different categories you want to use, but once I subdivided everybody on my team, then the process of selling became clear. How I want to do it, when I want to do it, okay? And again, know your league, know your situation. For example, trying to tank for the number one pick can be a good idea if you execute it faithfully and properly. But if you look at your league and you know, sure as shooting, that two other teams are going to be gunning for it too, then you may do everything you can possibly do and still not get it. So think about that too. So sometimes it's better to just make sure we're maximizing each individual asset than prioritizing my team in a direction and then just throwing everything overboard because I want the number one pick. Make sure you look at your league. Make sure you try to assess the directions of all the other squads before you decide, you know, on some incontrovertible, unfixable direction that you're going to head down. That's for Billy, but it's for everybody else. You know, don't use a cookie cutter approach. Look at your league. Look at the dynamics within your league. Look at your roster. Look at which players may be able to return value and some who may be able to return more value later. Look at the seasonal aspects of Dynasty. Leo Pasiga is phenomenal about this. I always tap Leo when I'm talking about something like this. Like, hey man, when do you think the best time to sell this player would be? And he almost always has an answer. So if you don't, I may not have the best answer to this particular question. It might be a guy like Leo, but I'm telling you right now, do a little due diligence before you just start throwing ballast over the edge. That's really the only point I got there. So we're going to wrap this podcast up now. Coming in around 45 minutes or so, not too bad. And I'm going to get back into regular podcasting. I'm going to be, as I said, getting the pod up on some of the platforms to help you guys out in terms of ease of listening. I know going to rotobond.com every time you want to listen is a pain in the ass. Don't blame you. So I'm going to be working on that. In the next week or so, we're going to have Rotobond rankings on the site. I've got an article coming up about all the various offensive coaching changes that went down in the league this year. Man, there are a lot of them. And I got to tell you, some of them are like just like little speed bumps that don't matter, and some of them are huge. So I will probably do a podcast about that article once that article's up as well. So as always, thanks for checking out the Rotobond podcast. As always, thanks for following me. Thanks for checking out the site. Things are really going to start heating up now, and August is going to be exceedingly active. One final note, first episode of the Fantasy Football Hour on WEEI 93.7 in the Boston area and throughout New England. Jim Hackett and I, my partner in crime, we're going to be back on the air this Sunday morning and every Sunday morning all the way through August in the football season. So that's something that I'm definitely excited for. We'll be talking Patriots probably a lot this Sunday, but definitely getting into more and more fantasy stuff as we progress up into drafting season. So once again, thanks for checking in. Please come back next time. We're going to have podcasts every week now going forward. It's fantasy football time, man. Giddy up. Garden sorting out. She curls.
sick from the warfare in your house. To each his own. The soldier is bailing out. He curled his lips on the bow.